Well, good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development Committee. I'm Representative Dave Pinto, the co-chair of the committee, along with Representative Dave Baker. Welcome to our guests and the folks joining us online. We have a couple presentations today and a couple bills that we're going to discuss. And so we will get going with that. We first have the minutes from our meeting from yesterday, February 24th. I'm sorry, today is the 25th. Yeah, so Tuesday the 24th. So we'll have a slight correction there. Mr. Chair, would you want to move approval of the minutes?
Yeah, move to approve. Thank you.
So members, any additions or corrections other than the one that I noticed that it was a Tuesday, February 24th rather than Wednesday? Nice sending any. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes, and our minutes from yesterday are approved. And then we'll get going then with the first presentation. We'll invite Susan Brower, our demographer, to make your way up. Members, Ms. Brower, Dr. Brower had presented to the Workforce Development System Reform Task Force, I think I'm essentially saying that right, that we set up last spring. Chair Baker is the co-chair of that task force. I'm a member of the task force. In December you presented, Dr. Brower, and I wanted to have the committee get the benefit of the information that you have as we're considering workforce shortages and worker issues. And so if you can please identify yourself and then proceed. And thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Susan Brower. I'm Minnesota State Demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. Please remind me if I don't lean forward enough and I get too quiet.
And if folks are having trouble hearing at all, please speak up.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Dr. Brower.
Thank you. So I want to talk today about the slowing of labor force growth, because it's something that's been happening since at least about 2010, something that we expect to see into the future. And so I want to make sure that folks understand just the inevitability, the inevitability of the trend, why it's happening now, and what we can expect in terms of future growth if we do indeed see future growth. If we continue to see slow growth, there are a number of implications of that for workforce development, for workers, for employers, and so I want to draw out those implications as well. So this is what Minnesota's workforce growth looks like over many decades. And you can see from 1970 up until about 2010, well, until about 2000, we saw really pretty rapid growth. That was while the baby boom generation was entering the workforce, while they were in the workforce, and they were kind of boosting that growth just by their very presence in the state. We began to see that grow and then plateau around 2010, 2011. In 2011, it was when the oldest of the baby boomers reached retirement age and began moving out of the workforce. We had folks moving in after them, but just not as many as were retiring. And so the growth leveled off, and we expect that into the foreseeable future. My office makes projections based on births, deaths, labor force participation, based on migration rates. We roll those together, and that's how we come up with numbers of how we expect our future population and our future working age population to look. And so given historic rates of domestic and international migration, given kind of just the age structure of the state, we expect this leveling off to continue. It varies depending on where you are in the state. If we look back over the past 10 years between 2014 and 2024, you can see that many counties in greater Minnesota have actually seen a shrinking prime age working population. This is the population 25 to 64. Any of these counties that you see in red or in kind of light pink red have seen some level of shrinkage in the number of people available to work. We do see growth in the metro, not the entire metro, but in many of the metro counties of the prime working age population. We've seen it in the last 10 years, but it's not the same level that we would have seen in the past prior to about 2010. And so all areas of the state are experiencing the slowdown, and some areas of the state are actually experiencing a contraction of the workforce, of the number of people who are available to work. In addition to the retirements of the baby boomers, we're still kind of partway through that transition. The youngest of the baby boomers born in 1964 have not yet reached retirement age, and so we're still seeing those transitions. And we're paying close attention to the cohort of young people who are moving into their working years. Sometimes demographics is very easy to predict, and this is one of those instances. If we look just at birth cohort by birth cohort in 2024, we can see a shrinking number of babies born each year, year over year. That pyramid that you see that's smaller at the bottom than at the top here shows us that there are fewer babies born each year, almost every year, since about 2007 was the height. And so we know that as those babies age into their working years, that there's going to be a smaller and smaller cohort kind of fueling that growth. That's one of the reasons why we know that the working age population is likely to remain kind of flat, or maybe a little bit of growth, maybe some contraction, depending on where you are in the state. Another way that the workforce can grow, of course, is by migration. So migration from other states, migration from other countries. We're looking here at the history of, one way to look at the history of migration into Minnesota. These are the net numbers, the net number of people gained or lost each year since the early 1990s due to either domestic migration, which is shown in the light gray, or international migration, which is shown in the dark blue. Starting with, and the line that's on this graph is showing you if you add domestic and international together, you get the total migration, so the total number of people gained or lost due to people moving in and out of the state in any given year. And in most years, you can see that it is positive. In most years, it is positive because of international migration and not because of domestic migration, although the 1990s were a little bit different. So kind of beginning with domestic net migration, since about 2002, we have seen net losses of Minnesotans moving to other states. They're relatively small. They usually, in any given year, they're under 10,000 people lost. And we're talking about much larger kind of flows of people in and out of the state, over 100,000 people in each direction in any given year. But the net of all that movement in most years since 2000 has been net losses. There have been a few years where that's not the case, including the most recent data point, 2025. And so we hope that we will continue to get a boost from migration from other states going forward. But as you can see from our long history, that's not necessarily a given that will continue. We did have a couple years in the late 2010s where we also had positive migration from other states on net. Now, looking at international migration, the blue bars are showing you the number of people who are gained from other countries, moved to Minnesota in each year. These are people from of all ages, whether or not they're working, but it just kind of generally gives you a sense of kind of the size and the change of those flows, those patterns over time. And we've seen generally growth over the decades in the number of people added because of international migration, particularly in the early 2020s, where we really saw a tremendous amount of growth due to humanitarian advents at the southern border. The U.S. saw this as well. It showed up in Minnesota's numbers, and you can see that we really had a historic high in terms of gains. In terms of the number of people added to the state who were international immigrants. That number in 2025 has been reduced by more than half. That's true for the U.S. overall as well, that we've seen immigration cut in half, and this will have implications for workforce growth as well. The 2025 number that you see here just over 10,000 people added due to international migration, excuse me, in 2025. Accounts for just the first half of the year, because that 2025 number is really a July to July number. So we don't even kind of have the full impact of the policy changes that the current administration has with regard to international immigration. It's about 6 months of decline due to that number there. In 2026, we won't have that number until the end of the year, but we would expect, if the current policies continue, that we will continue to see further declines in international immigration. The level of international migration that we saw in the late 2020s kept the labor force growth at a plateau. We saw what the numbers kind of looked like after 2010. There wasn't much growth, but underlying that was some of the kind of bolstering of growth that came from international immigration and very high levels of international immigration. And so I just want to point out that the current federal policies around international immigration will impact labor force growth or decline in ways that will be felt by Minnesotans. We're already starting to see what some of those numbers look like. We can expect that those numbers, if policies continue as they are, will decline further. Under a slow growth scenario, I think it's really kind of important to understand. It's always important, but especially under slow growth scenarios, it's important to understand who Minnesota's workers are and to ensure that everyone who's out there, the small number of people who are out there, the small amount of growth that we do have, that people are working and contributing their skills to the fullest potential. That's always the case, but I think it's especially the case when we have very little growth, when employers are looking for workers, and we don't have kind of that churn that sometimes fuels or aids in the recruitment of workers. And so looking at Minnesota's workforce today, about 24% are people of color, Black, Indigenous, people of color, BIPOC. That's just under 1 million workers. About 48% are women, 12% born in another country, and about a third are parents. When we look at the educational attainment of Minnesota's workers, we can see that in this graph here. You can see that there is a sizable share who have a high school degree or less, that there is room for growth in terms of the skills and training of Minnesota's workers, and that is one strategy in a slow growth scenario that we need to continue to be sure that we promote, is that continued skills growth. I also want to point out that significant disparities still exist with respect to race and ethnicity in Minnesota. Access to education and other barriers kind of produce these disparities that we see here in terms of attainment, that we see higher, lower rates of educational attainment for some populations of color, particularly Black or African American, Hispanic or Latino, and Native or Indigenous. Under, again, a slow growth context, we don't have the luxury, perhaps, of filling all the jobs that are potentially out there, and I think it becomes important in terms of public policy to start to look to essential jobs as we did during the pandemic. There are some jobs that absolutely must be filled for the health and well-being of our state. The National Conference of State Legislatures came up with this list It may not be the right list, but I just wanted to share it with you. When we think about prioritizing some jobs over other jobs, just what it means to be able to fill those absolutely essential jobs where we're caring for our residents, particularly vulnerable populations, where we're producing the energy and the food and the basic elements of daily life that we need to continue to move forward. We didn't maybe need to think about that in the past when we were growing without any kind of a care in the world. Now it becomes more of a concern to think about how do we prioritize filling some of these jobs that our communities absolutely need for their health and well-being. And so, kind of in sum, I do expect population growth, workforce growth, to continue to be slow in Minnesota because of those underlying factors, the aging of the population, the aging of the baby boomers, the lower birth rates that are producing smaller cohorts of young people aging into the workforce. This is something that is a stable pattern. I should note it's not just happening in Minnesota. It's happening across the U.S., particularly in states in the Midwest that have similar migration patterns as we do. Slow growth is just something that the U.S. and many states will need to grapple with going forward. International migration, I think, is the most realistic, most kind of the quickest, most expedient path to growth. Because the increase in a birth rate is very unlikely. That's a very stable feature that's much bigger than Minnesota. It's much bigger than the U.S. Historically, it's moving in one direction, and we don't see that turning around in any place that we look. And so under this slow growth scenario, it's really important to support educational opportunities, continue to make sure that the people that we do have are reaching their full potential and contributing to their full potential, and then also paying attention to jobs in essential industries, essential occupations, when we have kind of a scarce number of workers. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much. I'm seeing Representative Wayne Johnson. We'll go to you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I notice and maybe this is not in your expertise, but one thing that I don't see in here is that this is taken into account if we're in a static situation where nothing changes. But what about the fact that, and I bring it up, we had touched on it yesterday, AI is going to be playing a huge factor that a lot of, I still think that we're just haven't even started the how AI and robots are taking a look at what Amazon's doing and layoffs and what's happening in the white-collar world in the offices and stuff like that. That is there any forecasting that's being done to see what possibly tens to hundreds of thousands of people being available now in the workforce needing to be retrained will affect what you're presenting?
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. It's a good point. I have seen forecasts that I don't trust a whole lot, I guess I'd say. It is not that there will not be an impact. There certainly will be. The question is, what will the impact be and when? And I haven't seen any forecast that can speak to that in a way that's useful, I think, in my estimation. That's not to say that it will not have, we all know, it will have sizable impacts. It will change the calculus of the number of workers that we need, for sure. But we don't have a history to be able to predict it with any kind of certainty. What I will say is that I think we need to pay attention to how AI and other technologies are being integrated. I think we tend to think that they'll be integrated very quickly, as soon as we can imagine it, that they will be integrated, and that is not the case across the board. And then also pay attention to the number of jobs that cannot be replaced. They cannot be replaced fully by AI or by technologies. Maybe they can be made people can be made more productive in those jobs. But I think about the kind of direct care types of jobs in healthcare that requires someone to be in the same place as another human. I guess I would just point to the examples where we know that AI will not probably make the same kind of impact that it will in other jobs. So.
Representative Johnson, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, I guess my main concern is we're in session only so many months. We always seem like we're reacting and not being ahead of the game, that if there is a ways that we could start planning that, because right now we're dealing with, well, if everything stays this way, this is going to react, and all of a sudden, if we come in, say, next year, and all of a sudden we found out we have a summer of just mass layoffs because it has caught up, and all of a sudden the whole discussion is, what do we do to find training programs? How do we get these people reemployed and a total different thing? So I just hope we have somebody working on it and just even playing the game of what if,
yeah,
that we can start planning that instead of being months and months and months behind and we're not doing anybody any favors. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Zelesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. You know, my question is, the Star and Tribune in January talked about net migration into Minnesota, and the data that we have in 2024, there was a 44,000 net gain to Minnesota, and then in 25, it is 33,000 net gain. So I'm curious if you think, my first question is if you think that's going to continue dropping in that, and my second question is, the last IRS data shows that the income bracket of the growth is under 25,000 for their annual salary. So when I look at these essential jobs, wonder how we're planning, if that's the statistics we have for Minnesota, if how, what we're doing, you know, to prepare for skills training and, you know, the trades and all these things so we can build houses and, to your point, things that AI cannot do, bedside care at a hospital. But I'm wondering if you think it's going to continue on this trajectory where we're going to see a continual decline for net migration, and if the income is going to stay at an annual salary of under 25,000 and what the implications are for the state.
And Dr. Brower.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. In terms of the net increase of total population, I do expect that to continue to decline. Again, that's because we know that there will be more deaths due to an aging population. We expect that there will be fewer births due to falling birth rates. And that natural change, just births and deaths, has been the historic growth engine of Minnesota, and it's been fueling labor force growth for decades. We're at a point now where we will need to rely on migration from other states or from other countries, not now, but by the end of the 2030s, to grow at all. And that's a place that we've never been before. And so I think that it just raises the importance of, first, kind of gives this context that it's a very stable, predictable pattern, the slower growth. It's not unusual. It's just where we are in terms of our demographics today. And second, it points to migration, either from other states or from other countries. Now, other states are experiencing the same slowdown, and so oftentimes people move to opportunities. But if they're experiencing the same slowdown that we are, they may not have the same kind of push factors to go to another state to find a job if what they have right there is available to them already. And so I think it's not that we couldn't see a turnaround in migration, but if opportunities are existing in the places where people are already living, they may not have that same push to move elsewhere. We'll hear about a presentation in a moment about particularly targeting that issue of domestic migration. From my perspective, it could turn around, but it's certainly not a given. International migration, we know that there is a pool of people who want to come to the U.S. to work, and so that's why I say it's the most expedient path in terms of growth. Of course, federal immigration policies, you know, either will support that or will hinder that movement of people here. And so I think the migration piece is a real kind of question mark, the natural change piece is really easy to predict. What happens with migration is more of a question mark.
Marvelous. Lizakar, anything else?
Just one. Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Just one follow-up. Do you have any data on the net migration for our border states to Minnesota and then what that IRS income is for the people moving to that state? The reason I ask that is that I think we need to make sure we're having high-paying jobs available in the state of Minnesota and then make sure we have policies that create an environment where business is going to thrive in the state of Minnesota to garnish that higher wage in the state. So I'm curious if you have data, because we have winter up here, and they do too, but I'm curious what the border states are saying for Minnesota.
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can speak to overall migration to and from border states, and I can get you information on income of people. I'll say that generally, the migration patterns that we see, we're trading residents with our border states. That's where most people are coming from.
Okay. To Representative Hussein.
Thank you for being here, and thanks for providing us this wonderful presentations. You stated that you are working on and try to do better for reaching out to PIPOC community. Is there any plan? What's your plan, and how are you going to integrate, and how are you going to reach out to throughout the states?
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so my work is, for most of the year, the work that I do is to produce data that can help people understand what's happening in the state. Part of what we do is try to get as specific as we can to Minnesota communities, and I'll share one example of something that's in a report that we've produced, but we look I know it's an eye test, I'm sorry. We look specifically at groups that are cultural communities in Minnesota that the Census Bureau may not produce data for because they're not large groups nationally necessarily. And so we have a report on our site called The Economic Status of Minnesotans that break down different workforce and social and economic contexts by each of these groups that you may or may not be able to see here.
And I want to point out, this is the very last page of our packet, members, as well. It sort of included some extra slides. So, and I think that's probably true for folks online as well. If you go to the after the thank you page, you hopefully included a few extra resources, and this is the very last one. So anyway, please continue.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to provide this slide and to send the report that I'm referencing. So that's one way that we try to kind of meet what we're hearing from cultural communities and BIPOC communities in Minnesota, that they want more specific data. During the decennial census, my role switches a little bit from analyst to someone who's working more to engage with communities around data collection around the 2020 census, and that's when my work really is much more focused on engagement and talking with many other folks in the community about filling out their census form, why it's important to Minnesota.
Okay, Representative Hussein, looks like you're all done. Okay, Representative Greenman, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Brower. Still a resident, I think, of 63B. Glad to have you here. Just a few questions about how we, I know I have a little bit of South Minneapolis pride. We have great people in the district. Just a question sort of how this compares, because I think especially when we're talking about migration, right, we're a state, one of 49, and the question sort of national trends on some of those natural factors, as the baby boomers, as we've been talking about for 30 years, sort of going through the pipeline, and actually probably are a lot of the reason we need some of these healthcare and care facilities or workers. But how does this compare with the national data about what's happening as we think about Minnesota? Because we can only, there's only a We can only track so much if there's a decline. And then I have a few more questions.
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative. In terms of growth, Minnesota tends to be like the national average. But I will say that states in the Midwest tend to be a little bit older, tend to have less migration. And so we tend to have more of, in the Midwest and even the Northeast, we tend to have kind of less contribution from migration. There are states in the Midwest that are actually in natural decline, which Minnesota is not. Ohio is an example where you have more people passing away than you have people who are being born into the state. We're not there yet. We still expect another decade or so of growth from that. And so I would say just in compared to the nation, if we roll it all in, again, it's another hidden slide. I'm sorry, I add them in case I get questions. I will send this one along as well.
That's good. And again, I think we have it.
Oh, you have right? This one?
We do as well. Yep, it's right after the thank you page.
Okay.
Numbers.
Yep. So slide number 12 is showing you the regions of the state and that there has been a slowdown in the working age population by region. The south of the U.S., southern states, a vast region, but including Texas, including Florida, have seen a slowdown as well, just not to the same level that Midwestern states and Northeastern states have seen.
And it looks like that Midwest line is the flattest one for those who can. We've got it on paper in black and white. So
thank you.
Anyway, please continue.
Yes, the Midwestern state is at the bottom in terms of flattening out of prime working age growth due to those factors, aging, due to lower birth rates, due to migration patterns. But really, all states in the U.S. have seen this flattening, this leveling off of growth.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this reflect also international migration? I mean, or international immigration? Because I know that we have lower levels of that than you would see in the South. Like, is that also reflective in this, the difference between the South and potentially the Midwest? Well,
it looks like that's a yes. I think you're getting.
Mr. Chair, yes, it includes all sources of growth when we look at kind of the total population here.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think one of the questions for us is, as we think about both of these, the immigration question, which is a national one, a national conversation, and then the migration question, which I think is as much of a policy question. I mean, we are a democracy. Our policies is voluntary and incentivizing. But if we think about the policies that will allow people to both have kids and families and work, I'm wondering if we have any census data or if there's any sort of in looking at trends. You know, we passed paid family medical leave, and one of the reasons we did that was so that folks could both have children and care for those children and also be in the workforce. Do we have any, and I know that that's more of a policy question, but if there's any data about what, both here or in an international context, about what kinds of policy changes we could do to support people who are in that workforce age and also having children, if that's one of our goals.
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I think just given the slow growth context, we need to be not the data, but just kind of the logic of it is that we need to be supporting folks in all kind of contexts that maybe we didn't have the same economic incentive to support in the past, even though we had kind of the moral incentive to do so. The data suggests that for programs that support families, we don't see a change in the birth rate. That's sometimes a question. I know you didn't specifically ask that. We don't see a sizable change in the birth rate. But I think, you know, if we look at countries like Estonia, some of the Nordic countries, they've had really targeted kind of family support programs, hoping to turn the birth rate around, hoping to increase labor force growth. And that really hasn't played out in terms of growth. But it still remains important to support kind of any way that we can help people enter the workforce for any amount of contribution under this slow growth context. And so I guess I would point to programs like those as fitting or aligning with the slow growth context.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just more of a comment for us, because I think the distinction you made is really important, right? There's the question of if our policy incentives are to encourage more people to have more kids, that is a policy goal that we could talk about. I think that the other goal, and probably the more practical goal as we think about the reason that this slow growth is happening, and it's not just an American issue, it's a first world thing we're seeing all over the first world and economically developed countries, is what are the policies that we have to keep as many people in the workforce as possible? And I think that that's a different policy question, but it is, to me, it feels like where our focus should be is how do we keep everybody in who can be in the workforce and allow them to have kids and do the things that they want and we want to incentivize them doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First to Dr. Brower, I always appreciate your work and I'm like fascinated by it and I find myself wanting to spend hours and hours and days just like digesting.
I think you have an intern application possibly.
If this whole legislating thing,
I don't know, man,
it could
be a pretty good gig.
So I also appreciate the questions we've heard around the table so far, and I almost want to just pick up on what Representative Greenman was talking about, and I appreciate it, and I've been wondering this over the last few years, as it has felt like we, the two main political parties in Minnesota, have this deep divide over the direction that we want to take our state. But at the same time, I hope that we can be united around wanting growth in Minnesota. I sometimes wonder, you know, this is my fourth session, I sometimes wonder if we do, only just through our conversation. And you know, I don't want to blame anyone for that at all.
We DFLers wonder sometimes the other direction, I will say.
And I figured that might be the case,
yeah,
right?
Indeed.
And so there's part of me that's like, do we need to just adopt some resolution formally as the legislature to say we actually all agree that we want to grow, just so that we have a common set of values around growth. So you know what, Representative Greenman just moments ago, she said that we want to keep more people in the labor force, which that's true. Like, we want a productive society. We want growth. We want our economy to churn. We want wealth creation and economic security. And we want all of those things, I believe. I honestly had competing interests last night. It was either to watch Representative Greenman and her great presentation of public safety or to watch President Trump. And I achieved both last night. And in that, it's true. But as a part of that, the president recognized that that we actually have more people working nationwide than ever before, was one of the things that he said last night. And I wanted to ask, because I didn't see it in our presentation here, as it compares to the rest of the nation, what is our labor participation rate and what is the trend line of our labor participation rate?
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Minnesota has a historically high labor force participation rate, especially because of women's labor force participation. It tends to be quite a bit higher than the national average. What we see lately, and that many states in the U.S. have seen, is falling labor force participation rates, not of the prime age working population, but of because of the contribution or the retirements of older adults. That's just, again, a natural outcome of having older people of working age, if you're looking at 16 plus. So we've seen those overall numbers fall as people have retired. We have seen in the prime working ages over time very high labor force participation rates relative to other states in Minnesota, but they haven't moved upward much over the past 15 years. I'm looking to see if I have a secret slide on that. I do not. I can share that with you. It's remained really very stable, over 80% of those in prime working ages, which tells me that we may have reached a somewhat of a ceiling. Not that there aren't more people who could be brought into the workforce, but that it's going to be tough to get any additional folks in there, because as we've seen jobs open up, we haven't seen a similar movement into the workforce of people in their prime working ages, as we've seen labor force shortages kind of unfold over the last 10 or so years. So what that tells me is not that more people can't be brought in, but that it's going to be harder work or different policies in order to kind of change the context of work or the calculus of going into the workforce and leaving whatever it is you're leaving at home, whether it's children or whatever kind of care situation you might have. It just tells me that where we are today, it's going to be tough to get additional folks in their prime age in.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hope that we are able to evaluate that data, and maybe it will come at another hearing too. And so I would appreciate if you would be able to share that with us. And then I guess secondarily, I have been so curious, and in part because of some of the work that I do, I like looking at this data from, it's this page, looking at that graph and evaluating the impacts of international migration to Minnesota, specifically between 2021 and 2024, I have been so fascinated because it has been almost impossible to try and get a read as to the number of folks who are here with legal status versus those who don't have legal status. Looking back about 5 years, I think the number was somewhere around 82,000, but this chart, you know, with an international migration, you mentioned the incidents at the southern border, you know, suggests a very steep increase. And so I'm like, I've really been trying to get the hard data as to like how many people are here in Minnesota without legal status.
Dr. Brower?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a group that creates estimates of that. Obviously, it's not headcounts, because that wouldn't be a reliable way to collect that data. It's an estimate based on census data. You can see the methodology, but I'd be happy to provide that to you. My recollection is that as of 2023, the number of undocumented people in Minnesota's workforce was around 70,000. And so I can get that data to you.
We'll need to keep moving a little bit, Reverend Schultz. Maybe one final question.
Yeah, I was just going to finish off with a comment on this, Mr. Chair. So thank you. Yeah. So that's very interesting. First time I've heard that information about, I think I heard you say 70,000 people who are participating in the workforce here in Minnesota who don't have legal status. So that's fascinating. And then, you know, these charts suggest a significant increase over the last several years, which, you know, in total, I mean, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about what happened the last few months, but it was fascinating to me that Operation Metro Surge only removed approximately 4,000 people. It's a fascinating thing when you consider this trend line of international migration over the last 5 years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Rouse, for being here. Kind of following up on this international migration piece, you noted that we're going to largely have to depend on that because domestically we're just not seeing the growth and the birth rates are not there. I guess my question would be, from a historical perspective, I mean, we've seen bad policy before around immigration, so that's not a new thing. But from a historical perspective, can you kind of give us an idea of where you think we may end up around that, like where we've seen situations where immigration enforcement has been similar to what it is now, maybe not in practice, but immigration enforcement has been where it's been a lot of folks deported. Can you speak to an historical, if there's trends or not, where you've seen the kind of ebbs and flows of, you think we'll get back on a pace or a track where we'll actually see more international migration coming in that would help us.
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think if you would have asked me that question 15 years ago when I started this job, I would have expected to see different federal policies than we're seeing today, because I know how we need the labor force growth. And so I don't know what the future holds with respect to international immigration. I will say that the current federal policies are not that it is not only kind of the enforcement activities that are taking people out of Minnesota and out of our kind of worker pool, it's also kind of changes in policies to refugee admissions, ceilings on refugee admissions, for example, the slowing of processing of visas, and then people choosing not to come to the U.S. when maybe they would have before. And so I think there's kind of a number of different factors that are coming together to produce these very low kind of gains from international migration that we saw in 2025.
Chair Frazier.
That's all I have, sir.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you so much for being here for this presentation and the really robust conversation. I can't help but look at the map back on the change in prime working age population and see that the 7-county metro, but also our county and St. Louis County, is in the color that is most declining over the past 10 years. And just curious if you're seeing, like, what you're seeing, why those are such acute differences in those areas, and kind of what are the impacts or the differences, why that acuity?
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So the northern part of the state is aging faster than the rest of the state, in part because it doesn't have, it has Duluth, but Duluth hasn't been growing at the same rate that some of the other metros. If you look at this map, for example, you can see the Fargo-Moorhead, the Clay County on the western edge in a light colored blue. You can see Olmsted County where Rochester is located. And I think some of our metro areas kind of fuel growth by kind of pulling people in from surrounding counties and by also pulling people in from other states and other countries. And so I think the story is both one of the northern part of the state being older on average because of lower birth rates, because of an aging population, less migration into those areas. But also because the northern part of the state doesn't have some of those same fast-growing metropolitan areas. Duluth has been the exception in terms of growth, in terms of what we've seen as higher levels of growth in metro areas.
Representative Kozlowski, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto, and I appreciate that. And I spent quite a bit of time working on census before coming to the Capitol, and so I appreciate the work of really making sure that how we're tracking so we can get good data. And I also can't help but look at this presentation and see that, you know, the numbers that 32% are parents, that 24% are people of color, which I believe our population has higher birth rates, you know, 12% born outside of the country, but in every category, we're finally on the map on that back page on Dakota and Ojibwe. And it's very rare to sit in these spaces, as you talked about, how we're kind of often categorized as minuscule. But when we look at the imbalance and the work that we have in this committee and at the legislature to remove and really tackle the structural barriers, this goes across childcare, healthcare, housing, food sovereignty, economic development, all of it. Mm-hmm. But that the places that we can really lean into, it seems like we have some work, so don't be surprised, members, if we bring forward bills that really target bringing more generation and growth and stability to our northern region, but then also in those other areas of decline, but also matching where we see, you know, on this last page, I can see Dakota and Ojibwe people, 47% and 36%, as well as other American Indians, are skyrocketing in comparison. 41% not in the labor market. Well, we know at the same time that immigrants, that people of color, have some of the highest labor participation and start small businesses, which means economic tax-based, commercial tax-based generation for us all. And so really continue to lean in there where we have the biggest opportunity for really being able to right size, but also bring folks in to meet the needs in our workforce decline, and also make sure that our communities stop being overrepresented. And when we finally make the map, that we're falling off the charts in the worst way. So thank you for illuminating that.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. And yeah, I agree. This is if we're going to address our workforce shortage, getting into the details really matters. And I so much appreciate this disaggregation of identifying in the different communities in our state. So helpful, Dr. Brower. And then I just have one final question that I think you've essentially gotten to, but I really want to make sure we're clear, because there really is a shared growth agenda. I think we can disagree about exactly where the individual policies that lead to that. Given our natural rate of growth in our state, births and deaths, given our status as a wintry location, et cetera, how important is international immigration to growth in our state? Like, how important is that to Minnesota? Is it something that's sort of a nice to have? Or like, where would you rank that in terms of how important it is if what we want is growth?
Mr. Chair, I'd say that it is our most likely source of growth, and that I don't expect that births and deaths and the trend that we've been seeing there will turn around, that they're very stable. I guess how important is it depends on whether the jobs that we need to have filled are being filled. And I guess that's a question for people who are working in direct care. If we just look at the jobs that immigrants are kind of concentrated in, it's across the board. It's, you know, many in healthcare, many in production and manufacturing, a high proportion in, computer science, in software, a high proportion who are not just the kind of lower skilled healthcare, but physicians. And so I guess immigration is already fueling the jobs, the filling of those jobs, those important jobs that we have in the state. It will be an important way to fill those jobs in the future, too.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Well, members, thank you so much. Representative Berg, you had something? Yeah.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have more of a curiosity. What are your thoughts on folks who have jobs where their bodies break down? I'm thinking warehouse workers. I'm thinking PCAs who have to lift individuals. We have a lot of the jobs that are wholly necessary but are also really hard on the body. I was curious if that includes miners on the Iron Range. I'm just kind of curious about how these jobs that are really hard on people's bodies may be forcing them to leave the workforce before they normally would. Is there anything to that? Thank you.
Dr. Brower.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, we do see retirements earlier in some of those occupations. The one that comes to mind for me is in construction and manual labor. And so I guess that's one indicator that that happens. The other kind of indicator that comes to mind for me is one that's in that economic status report that I referenced that has these breakdowns of cultural communities. We have rates of disability by each of these groups. And you can see higher rates of disability among Dakota and Ojibwe, among Black or African American residents, and so there's kind of a racial and ethnic cultural component to that as well that plays into those labor force participation rates.
Thank you. Okay, good. Thank you. Dr. Brower, thank you so much for your presentation. We really, really appreciate it. It's been very helpful.
Thank you for having me.
And members, as you have other questions that come up, we've got Dr. Brower as a really terrific resource. We're inviting our Explore Minnesota friends to make your way on up. And as they do, I'll note that I don't know if Chair Baker knew this, if we talked about it, but I learned that you apparently are required to give a report
a presentation to the legislature every year, which you do as part of your bills usually. But I want to make sure that that actually happened this year, and so in this form, and so invited you to come in. Once you're ready, Director, if you can identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. Delighted to be here today. My name is Lauren Bennett McGinty. I'm the Executive Director of Explore Minnesota, and I'm going to give a brief overview of who we are, what we do, and then a snapshot of what happened last year. You all should have our suitcase in front of you, the sort of star of every legislator's office, if I do say so. And you also have county level data, which is brand new this year. We made sure that every single county in the state of Minnesota got their own data sheet, and that is specifically to tell you the impact of tourism in your county. Explore Minnesota's role is really to sustainably grow Minnesota's economy through by welcoming all to innovative and inclusive marketing, storytelling, and industry partnerships. And really, at our core, we drive visitation to the state of Minnesota. We support local businesses, we strengthen communities, and we ensure that the investments that's made on behalf of Minnesotans deliver measurable economic value through new net dollars to the state of Minnesota. I'm not going to read through every single word on this page, but we are guided by these five strategic imperatives to ensure that our work works. And from tourism and livability to outdoor recreation and film, the investments by the Minnesotans really focus on improving the program performance. And I can tell you that all of our programs together do help grow awareness of Minnesota throughout the country and globally. Here's a quick budget overview. As you can see, we spend the majority of our budget on marketing and communications because that is our job. You also see a large piece of the pie going to technology and operations, and I will tell you that that is primarily our website, right? ExploreMinnesota.com. Hopefully you've all been there to plan your vacations, but it is one of the core marketing components that we use all the time at Explore Minnesota. But you'll also see substantial investments in the industry. So we work with approximately 130 destination marketing organizations throughout the state. So those are folks who collect lodging taxes on behalf of their cities or counties, and we ensure that they have resources like education, industry engagement, co-ops, and industry grants. I'll also note we did have some one-time legislative appropriations. Those are pass-through grants. So to be clear, we take those dollars in and we send them out the door, so that does not impact our regular budget. We also have the Explore Minnesota Film, which is a separate budget of $825,000 that, again, does not impact our primary budget. As you can see, these numbers from 2024, I will remind you that our numbers are a year behind in the tourism business. So this is from 2024 by Tourism Economics, but we welcomed 81 million visitors, which really helps offset household taxes by $1,031 annually. That number has grown significantly by $20+ in the since the last time I was here. But you can also see that we contribute significantly to the jobs and economy portion of the state. We bring in $2.4 billion in state and local taxes, $1.8 billion in federal taxes. The total personal income combined of all the tourism-related workers is $8.3 billion, and there are 182,000+ jobs generated. And that all serves to provide a $24.7 billion economic impact to the state of Minnesota. One thing that we did new this year is we started tracking over the last 20 years. We felt it was important to demonstrate growth that we've had, despite the fact that our budget has sort of grown somewhat, but not necessarily significantly. We wanted to ensure you understood the efficiency of the dollar that we work with. So we have grown visitation in the last 20 years by 185%. Growth in visitor spending by 47%, and growth in sales tax generated by 300%. And sales tax generated usually goes either directly to the state or the locality in which it's spent. So I think those are really positive attributes to the state general fund as well as communities. You'll also see that for every $1 we spend at Explore Minnesota, we return $477 to state tourism businesses and $47 in tax revenue to the state. And then one thing I love to point out is that without Explore Minnesota's marketing, we would actually be down $1.5 billion. So thanks to the work that we do, that adds an additional $1.5 billion in spending to the state of Minnesota. So I mentioned it very briefly earlier, but we do have a very integrated marketing program that spurs economic development in the state. Primarily, the bread and butter is tourism. That's what we spend most of our money on, but we also have outdoor recreation, film, livability, and new resident attraction and community livability efforts. I can get into some of the data. I love presenting after Dr. Brower because it's sort of a good platform to share all the work that we have done in that area. But we really like to say when we invest in one area, we do strengthen them all. I think it's important to note that tourism is the front door to economic development. When somebody visits Minnesota, we know that they are 55% more likely to want to live in Minnesota. And so it's really important that we give a good first impression, but also that we keep working on them through our marketing. Quick overview of our other programs, brand new in 2024, Explore Minnesota Film. Since we started that program at the state, we've experienced a 200% increase in productions and enhanced marketing for the state. We have 13 productions in the pipeline right now, in addition to many others that don't necessarily qualify for the tax credit, as you need to spend $1 million in the state of Minnesota to do so. And then we also work with partnerships around the state, including Greater Minnesota, in which most of the films are being made, and the Upper Midwest Film Office is a big generator of films as well. And again, that's a separate $825,000 annual budget. Our outdoor recreation works with DEED, DNR, and IRRR as well to grow the outdoor recreation economy. The goal here is really to enhance all of the opportunities for people, not only to come and visit, but the economy itself, which, as you can see, contributes greatly to the state's economy and has a $23.5 billion economic output. Outdoor recreation is really big business in Minnesota, as I'm sure you're all aware. And that budget, again, very small but very efficient. It's $150,000 out of our base budget. So marketing, I heard some talk of winter. I can tell you we do market winter, and people have started to be more excited about winter. Coolcationing is a trend, so check it out. If you don't like going outside in the winter, there's a lot of opportunities. But we do year-round visitation. We try really hard to balance regionally, and then we segment our audiences so that they align with who wants to come here so we get the best bang for our buck. One of the things that was also mentioned earlier, but this is a totally different experience, is AI. It has really come for all of us at this point. And for those of you who might use those lovely summaries at the top of Google, Gemini has in the first year since Gemini started, it took away 40% of the clicks directly to our website, which is pretty huge. So what we've done in the last year is redesign our website to ensure that all the information that we have is getting fed into Gemini and that we're one of the primary sources of information for people to click once we get there. So we always hit the top of, if you Googled visit Minnesota, we would always be the number one. And now the information from our site is going into Gemini and we're one of the first clicks there too. So we've really worked on optimizing that because if people visit our website, they're more likely to visit cities and counties' websites as well. So we're really using our authority to support communities around the state. Another thing that we do is we earn media coverage for the state of Minnesota. As you can see, we earned 2.85 billion impressions through various tactics throughout the last year, and then $10.2 million in ad value. We were able to be present in places like Chicago. I was there for another big meeting that we had, so I took advantage and I went on their daytime show. We were present here in the Twin Cities because we know it's important to get folks from the Twin Cities to Greater Minnesota. And then we have really strategic placements in a lot of big magazines, both nationally and internationally. So we're driving positive media coverage about Minnesota as well. Industry support is really critical for us. Without the industry, we actually wouldn't be as successful as we are. The industry in Minnesota, DMOs across the state, support moving people around, trying new things in their backyard, working within sort of the border states of Minnesota to drive traffic. So we work with them for strategic marketing, training, and tools and resources. We just had our annual tourism conference in Duluth. And we do have a co-op program which buys down the cost of advertising, so small destinations can afford to buy advertising in places like the Star Tribune or NPR, which might be a little bit more expensive traditionally. We also have industry grants, and in the last year, we gave out 117 grants worth $899,600. We also, between grants and co-ops, directly contributed to the industry with $4.3 million in investment. And this is really to help grow revenue throughout the cities of the state of Minnesota. You know, from Hennepin County, where maybe major events are stimulating the economy, arts and dining, to places like St. Louis County, where outdoor recreation and regional attractions support really small businesses, mom and pop resorts. We're really focused on moving money around the state and driving in new dollars to those locations. So with things like grants, folks are able to kind of amplify their reach and ensure that they can make their dollars go farther as well. And this is really great timing with the questions that were asked earlier, and I actually was messaging with my team, so apologies for being on my phone, but I wanted to make sure that I had the data. But one of the things that we worked on in 2025 was a livability campaign to attract more workers to the state of Minnesota. Clearly, that is a topic you are all interested in. We no longer have funding for that. It was one-time funding, but we do have lots and lots of resources we were able to invest those dollars into. And, you know, what we will say is that we know that 76% of people aware of Explore Minnesota advertising, which includes both tourism and livability advertising, think it's a great place to live. So that's a 19% lift in positive perception of Minnesota. Even further, we did do a resident retention campaign for 18 to 25-year-olds that drove 621,000 web sessions. We had a very Gen Z-friendly website that we made for them with lots of gifts, and they seemed to enjoy it. And then it had 161.4 million impressions on the advertising that we did. That was just to folks in-state, around college campuses, to try to convince them to stay, plant their roots in Minnesota. And one question that was also asked earlier is what is attracting people to move here? We have done research on this before we set out to do this campaign, and I can tell you that in 2023 to 2024, we did research around new transplants to the state of Minnesota to rate their most important attributes as to why they moved here. The number one was that it is a place where I can see myself being happy for a long time. It's a beautiful place to live, has high-quality health care, good for overall health and well-being, and has access to nature and outdoors. So other things in there include things like affordability, achieving career goals, welcoming to all, and have one of the big ones I think that we actually see a lot from the coast is that people can afford to buy a home, where you can't typically do that on the East or West Coast. So I just wanted to make sure you had that data. Happy to follow up. I don't have it in my slides here, but I'm happy to follow up with more information as you are all talking about how do we get more Minnesotans.
And we will need to have you wrap up pretty quick, I'm afraid.
Sure. So as you can see, we're ranked very highly in a lot of places. One of the big things that we do is use the rankings where maybe we're not in the top five to kind of drive growth. So I will just kind of quick shift to our summer campaign. I've learned my lesson that media doesn't always work here, so I put it on silent so you can at least see it. But our summer campaign really focuses on family-friendly vacations, multi-generational, multi-family trip to a family-owned resort in the Detroit Lakes area. It'll launch on March 9th and will include 11 states within the region. It also targets Dallas and Chicago because they've been really good markets for us. And then the primary tactics, of course, are social media as well as key marketing partnerships and different digital publications, and of course more traditional advertising like connected TV across various sites and markets. And then finally, Explore Minnesota really does continue to efficiently and effectively generate tax revenue and use tax dollars. We build on that strategy to make sure that we're increasing awareness everywhere. We collaborate with all of our state partners, and we position Minnesota for long-term sustainable growth. So I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much for your work, Director. Representative Lesnikar. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, sure. Representative Lesnikar.
Yeah, quickly, thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My question is on the investment on trails, because we've invested a lot in Minnesota in trails. And in 2023, the University of Minnesota did a study on Kuching in St. Louis County and Lake County, and it was $36 million of net gain to the region and then to the state. So my question is, when we look at trails, walking trails, biking trails, snowmobile trails, horse trails, and ATV side-by-side trails, are you tracking any metrics to see the usage, what people are coming into the region for, and then with our investments in these different areas to see if there's any, if it's been double, triple the investment, the net gain for the state? Just curious. Thank you.
I'm not sure if that's more of a DNR thing, but Director, please.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. That is typically more of a DNR thing, but I can certainly connect with our outdoor recreation deputy just to check in on that. What I will say is almost every single campaign that we put out, whether it is a major campaign or a niche campaign, it almost always includes outdoor recreation and almost always on a trail somewhere. So we do drive a lot of traffic to those locations and have seen significant growth. The Bureau of Statistics, Economic Statistics federally will release outdoor recreation numbers soon, so we will see hopefully what that looks like, and hopefully there's an increase.
Okay, thank you. And if you can get us that information, that'd be great. Chair Baker, then to you, sir.
Thank you, Director. Again, I know it's maybe early, you don't have the information, but I'm really curious about the World Junior Hockey Tournament feedback. Again, was able to watch the game this year. It was kind of fun to do that with our team, but anyway, just any initial feedback of our investment to that in the last couple months? Thank you.
Director.
Thank you, Chair and Chair Baker. Yes, I can tell you that it was very well received. Unfortunately, I do know that the Canadian numbers were a lot lower than I expected. Certainly can provide more feedback from Minnesota Sports and Events as well. But what I will say is that the attendance overall, especially from Minnesotans in Rice Park and kind of driving to St. Paul, was really good. And reports of really amazing hospitality. I think the Hockey Association was very pleased with how it turned out despite some of those lower ticket numbers. So I think overall it was really well received.
Thank you. And Director, I want to ask this. So the last couple months, federal immigration activity in our state, can you talk about the impact of that, your perspective in terms of tourism and kind of, I think in some ways our state's, some views of our state may have been enhanced around the country. There may be some concerns the opposite direction. I'm just wondering if you can comment on, but in particular on the impact of federal activity on our state.
Thank you, Chair. So, you know, we do have some data on that. We just released a survey. We had more than 200 responses of tourism businesses around the state. I will say 46% of the businesses report being at least slightly impacted, dollar amount wise. And then it is statewide because only 41% of the people who reported being impacted are from the metro. So obviously it has kind of a larger impact. I do think there's probably a lot more tourism impact than we're immediately seeing because winter is typically a slower time for tourism anyway in Minnesota. So I'm really hoping that we'll start to see more data come out and that because we were able to shift some of our winter marketing dollars to our summer campaign, that we'll be able to drive more tourism in summer. But in general, I know that restaurants and hospitality businesses are down significantly right now just because I think there's a lot of fear of going out and patronizing them. So at this point, it is hard to say. We do have some anecdotal data of different businesses saying that they are down significantly and hoping that they can bounce back up as the weather gets better. But our job will then be to continue to improve perception and ensure people feel safe and welcome when they come.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. And if you have more information, please follow up with us, and I suspect we'll be in touch with you further about that. Members, not seeing anything else, we'll get to the bills. Director, thank you so much for your work and the presentation. And then Representative Hussein, you're making your way to the front. Representative Hussein moves House File 3004 to bring that before the committee. And my plan is to lay this bill over, members, just to confirm. Representative Hussein, there's the A3 amendment, author's amendment, which I know changes the bill to turn it into a competitive grant, and I know there was the other change as well we discussed. I'm trying to recall if maybe staff, Micheline, can you just remind me what the other change in the A3 amendment is, if you recall? Oh,
thank you. Chair and members, the A3 amendment takes the 26 appropriation out of the bill since that year fiscal year will be closing in June and puts all of the money into fiscal year 27. It also converts the grant program into a competitive grant program instead of a direct grant to a specific named grantee.
Okay. And Representative Hussein, you're moving the A3 author's amendment?
Yes, moved.
Okay. Thank you. Any discussion to the motion, members? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the A3 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. That motion passes. Representative Hussein, to your bill, sir.
Thank you, Chair and members. Good morning. House File 3004 is about access to opportunity. Minnesota already has workforce training programs, but this is a unique and a little bit different. This is a challenge of awareness. Many young people simply do not know those opportunities exist. Today, whether it's a student finds appropriate training often depend on, you know, who they know, not where to find a great job opportunity. If you have connection, you learn about your job. If you don't know, then you might never know. This bill created a digital platform, which is bring all workforce opportunity in one place in the state of Minnesota. And this bill came from the young generation who's right here today with me to testify. So I'll yell for them to explain a little bit more about the bill.
That's good. We'll rely on the young people. So please make
Samir Mohammed.
Yeah, please make your way on up. We'll have the first two testifiers, I think, both of you. Yeah, come on, take a seat. And also Maitreya Breeder, feel free to come on up as well. I will tell you, we've got 10 minutes allocated for the presentation of the bill, just sort of for timing as well. I'll look to Mr. Nathan, my constituent, and Mr. Rogers as well, just to be aware of that for timing. But we definitely want to be giving our time to our young people. So if you can, whichever of you is going to go first, please identify yourself, say who you are, and then proceed with your testimony. And welcome to you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Samia Mahmoud, and I'm here as a youth policy intern with Catalyst for Systems Change. And I'm here to explain what Catalyst for Systems Change is and what exactly this bill aims to do. So Catalyst for Systems Change is a nonprofit that works with young people in rural, suburban, and the urban areas of Minnesota. We came together last year in November to identify youth legislative priorities so we can help pursue them, connecting with legislators and hopefully getting them passed throughout the legislative season. So the bill that you see in front of you is an initiative to try and get more kids interested in work in the workforce. And I want to talk about what this bill actually aims to do. So it expands access to workforce opportunities. I want to say that many young people, especially in rural areas of Minnesota, do not have access to equal workforce opportunities as suburban and urban kids do. Many young people, especially ages 15 to 23, don't know where they can find internships, apprenticeships, mentoring, or entry-level jobs. Opportunities are scattered across different websites, schools, nonprofits, and private employers. And this aims to create a centralized digital platform where students can find internships and stuff like that with Catalyst for Systems Change to help them expand on that. We literally watched a presentation today from these wonderful ladies, I do not know where they went, on how important it is to kind of expand our workforce with the age population who is in the workforce right now slowly declining, and as we are getting older and students are not having the same amount of access to the workforce, there should be a solution to that. And we see that there are programs out there, but nothing is centralized. Students don't have the access because there's no advertising or any communications between these programs. So our aim is to bring it statewide, make it one digital platform for students to have an equal opportunity to do something that they are passionate about. And thank you.
Thank you so much. Can I ask, have you testified in a legislative hearing before?
I have.
Okay,
I'm also a speech and debate kid.
Well,
so.
I'm not surprised. I think you're probably prize winning. I'm gonna bet. So
that's one of the wonderful programs that we're funding in the state.
Yes. So, wow. Good. Well, thank you so much. Yeah. To our second testifier, please identify yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you. My name is Maitreya Breeder. I am a resident of Minneapolis and a senior at St. Anthony Village High School, and I'm also the 2025 awardee of the National John Lewis Youth Leadership Award. And I would also just really like to reiterate the importance of what my colleague Samia just said. My life has been changed irrefutably and completely by the opportunities that were available to me in high school, including the nonprofit Catalyst for Systems Change. When I started high school, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And I was then exposed to internships, extracurriculars, jobs, and people that absolutely transformed that fact. At 17, I joined Catalyst for Systems Change, and I passed a piece of original legislation through this state legislature implementing my own idea of overdose response training and health class curriculum. And I am now graduating with a strong interest in policy and government and an intention to major in political science in college. And I helped my community along the way. But almost every single opportunity that I got to take advantage of, an organization that I got to work with, I had to discover and I had to pursue completely on my own, which is an unrealistic expectation of every single student in Minnesota. Every day I see other youth like me who are so passionate and so driven about things that they believe in, but they simply lack the resources and the knowledge to get involved. And something that I always say to the youth that I work with is that you do not need to be older or more formally educated to have a voice in democracy or to be an effective participant in the population. You need to be informed. And it is the duty of the people with the information to then spread that information. And if we make this information accessible, youth engagement won't depend on what or who you know. It'll depend on your willingness to serve. Because one day all of your seats will be filled by people from my generation. And I hope that you value expertise, experience, and that willingness to serve in a politician as much as I do. Because this is how. So I'm in full support of House File 3004, the Youth Workforce Digital Platform. This is an investment in the future of our population and the future of our democracy and workforce. And I strongly urge you to vote in favor. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. If we were feeling discouraged about our future workforce in the first half of the hearing, I at least am feeling a lot better now. So really terrific.
And Mr. Roger,
yeah,
we'll
yeah, come on, yeah, come on up.
And Joe.
Yeah. Welcome. And yeah, please identify yourself. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly right. You know, except that I suspect he's been working with those too, so he can have some of the glory too. Please identify yourself and proceed. Good to have you here, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Khalik Rogers. I'm the Executive Director of Catalyst for Systems Change, and that was a tough act to follow. As
yeah,
you clearly
indeed,
see.
indeed.
To be completely honest with you, the goal and the epicenter of why this organization was created was this very fact that. You know, my journey of getting here was like jumping off the porch into a street full of fog. You know, it's not oftentimes that young people have the clairvoyance or the direction that, or just the mentorship or stewardship that they actually need.
Right.
We expect young people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps when in fact they don't even have boots. And this is an opportunity for the state to actually listen to the priorities of young people and also listen and take not just their voice, but their direction of how they receive information, how they spread information, and how we can actually listen to their innovation that they deeply have. I also just want to state, for many young people, opportunity is not limited by talent, but it's limited by access. When you lack connection, it's hard to build relationships. If networks shape opportunity, we must give every young person a fair chance. In the recent weeks, youth across Minnesota have shared their fears and uncertainty are affecting their ability to participate in school, work, and leadership opportunities. When young people feel they are when young people feel unsafe or disconnected, they're disengaged from experiences that shape their future. Workforce pathways are strongest when they reflect what young people identify as their interests and strengths. When youth can explore careers aligned with their talents, creativity, they are more engaged, confident, and prepared to contribute to Minnesota's economy. And I think after these different presentations we've heard today, it's important to have more of a cross-sector collaborative effort mm-hmm. that aligns these systems because they are deeply integrated, and at the epicenter of those issues lies the lives of young people and their future. So please support House File 3004. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and I think to my constituent, Joe Nathan, you're going to be testifying as well to my constituent.
Good morning,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, members Thank of the you. Committee. My name is Joe Nathan. I have been a public school teacher and administrator in this state, as well as a researcher since 1971. I'm old. What I want to suggest to you is four things. First, In 2015, the Minnesota legislature on a bipartisan basis passed something called the attainment goal. The idea was that because of extensive research, the vast majority of jobs would require some form, not necessarily a four-year degree, but some form, a certificate, a two-year degree, or a four-year degree, the vast majority. And so the legislature established what was called the attainment goal. It wanted by 2025 to have at least 70% of all the groups in the state, African Americans, American Indians, Native Americans, Hispanic Americans, white, low income, all groups to have at least 70%. Not a single group attained that goal by 2025. Part of the problem is that we have not made effective use of the programs that we have. We have talked, some of us have talked about, for example, PSEO. I want to tell you the good news that we had a hearing earlier this week showing that there was bipartisan support for establishing a committee, including young people and including educators, to examine how that law, which allows the state of Minnesota to save $15 million a year for taxpayers as well as $60 million a year for educators. There's a desire to have a study of that to see how we can more effectively prepare young people and more effectively use the tax money that we already are spending. So our proposal here is to take a look at the document that you've received where you see literally dozens of websites, but no central place. And we have convened young people from all over the state, from the Duluth area, from Moorhead, as Representative Baker knows from our past support and work with him, from the Wilmer area, all over the state. Young people don't know where to go. So we are asking for a small appropriation. We recognize your dollars are very little. We're asking for a small appropriation to involve young people this summer or next year and make a report to you in 2027 about how we can more effectively gather the information and share it to young people via the social media. They know more about TikTok. They know more about various social media platforms. We have enormous amounts of money going into the creation of these websites, but young people tell us they don't know about it. So we respectfully request a small appropriation. We respect that that a number of you don't want to have direct appropriations. We respect that. We want to try to help you make the best possible use of the taxpayers' money. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nathan. Members, I want to make sure we can get to the final bill, so I have to keep comments relatively limited, but I want to make sure if somebody has something they want to ask about or comment, please do. We'll see if we have anybody. We're not seeing anyone. I'll just, Chair Frazier, were you? I wasn't sure. Okay. Oh, yeah, Chair Frazier.
I just want to acknowledge these two young people again.
Indeed.
Thank Indeed. You for being here. I mean, I'm a girl dad, so I have all daughters. And seeing you today made me think of my daughters. Very proud of you and what you're done and what you're accomplishing.
Indeed.
And this is why we have to invest in our young people. Thank you.
Yeah, I can tell that's a sentiment being shared all around the table, uniting all of us, which is nice because it doesn't always happen. So appreciate that. Okay, good. Well, I'll say one of the reasons that I wanted to hear this, besides the importance of bringing young people into the workforce, is we are looking a lot at how we can make sure that workers are more aware. I know Chair Baker and I share this. Workers are more aware of the opportunities that are available. We just have a system that is sort of working as effectively as possible, and this seemed like an exciting thing to examine. So we'll see what we can do in terms of budgets and have conversations, but so grateful to the folks who brought this to us, especially our younger testifiers. And slightly less young testifiers, and still grateful to you as well. And Representative Hussein, thanks for your work on this. With that, the chair lays over House File 3004, and thank you again to all of you. Appreciate it. And then Representative Jones.
I just want to remark close.
I'm sorry, Representative Hussein, you do get your closing. I'm so sorry, sir. Everybody, hold on. I'm taking that back. Representative Hussein gets to get final comments as the bill author. Please.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. This is a platform organizing opportunity into one place for students, parents, and counselors and employees. This bill does not just create an opportunity. It refills opportunity when young people can see a pathway, they are more likely to work it. And this is a great bill. This is a beautiful bill. I want you to guys all support it. Thank you.
All right, good. Thank you. So with that, the chair finally does lay over House File 3004. Thank you, Representative Hussein. Representative Jones, make your way on up. I will ask
Representative Greenman, would you mind moving House File 3663, bring it before the committee?
So moved.
Thank you. No author's amendment I'm seeing, and so Representative Jones and your testifiers, let's just, yeah, we can just quiet down a little bit. So I see no author's amendment, and apologies that we're a little bit tight on time. Representative Jones, if you can please describe your bill, and we'll go to your testifier.
Yes. Is this on? Yeah. Okay.
It's on.
Great. Well, thank you so much. You know, as it was said, that was a hard act to follow, but a really good one. And I do hope that the youth consider energy efficiency and building code careers in the future. Hi, I'm Representative Katie Jones. So thank you for having me in your committee today to present House File 3663 for energy code support grants. So I'd like to start with a question. What is the cheapest and cleanest kilowatt hour of energy? The answer is the one you never use. We all use and need energy in our everyday lives, especially in Minnesota, to heat, cool, and power our buildings. But being energy efficient with our energy helps us to save money and avoid pollution. It's a win-win across the board. So another question, how and when is it the best time to implement energy efficiency?
Right.
The answer, when a building is first being built. It's cheaper to put in insulation and air sealing, check for leaks with a blower door test, and remedy them to implement, you know, triple pane windows, all of those types of things when the building is under construction. Retrofits are just more cumbersome. It disturbs people. You have to move furniture. No one wants to do that. And this is why Minnesota has been a leader on energy code since the 1980s. The energy code continues to evolve, thanks to this body and especially the work done in the past few years. So alongside the traditional prescriptive checklist pathway, development teams now have performance-based options. So think about energy modeling, and this basically is more intensive. It requires a more intensive understanding of building science. The benefit is that performance-based pathways can result in construction methods that are more cost-effective and result in more energy-efficient buildings. Because this is a newer pathway, code officials just have less familiarity. They're also tasked with not only ensuring the compliance of energy code, but electrical code, plumbing code, all of these other codes. And it's hard to be an expert on every single thing. And so our solution is to make technical assistance more available. Building code is mostly implemented by cities in Minnesota, even though we have a statewide code. So this bill creates a grant program for cities to tap into and select technical experts for support, education, training, and tools to help them with compliance implementation. The program would be overseen by DALI, which it is my understanding that they have the capability to do. And also I want to note that conversations with a number of cities show support for these grants. To close, our buildings stand for decades, if not centuries. Constructing them to use energy efficiently from the beginning reduces utility costs from day one and over the lifetime of a building. Giving cities access to technical tools for improved energy code implementation ensures owners and tenants alike can reap those benefits. It's a win-win across the board. So I ask for your support for House File 3663 and welcome my testifiers to talk more about their perspective from both a city and energy efficiency expert.
Okay. I think we thought we just had the one testifier you'd signed up. We'll need to keep things very quick, as you can imagine. So we'll go, I think, Megan Hoy, I think you're going to go first. If you can keep it very short.
Wonderful. I'll be short and quick. And I love the raising the roof on the energy efficiency jobs from the youth that were here before. Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chair, and members of this committee. My name is Megan Hoy. I'm the Director of Climate Equity Action with the City of Minneapolis. I oversee the sustainability team with the city and our Climate Equity Action Plan. I have worked in sustainability and clean energy in the built environment for nearly 20 years and started my career in architecture. In 2023, as was mentioned, the legislature took an action to ensure that Minnesota would update the building energy code at a faster rate, every 3 years when a new national code and standards are published. This was an important step forward to making buildings more efficient, cost effective to operate, and aligning with our state and the City of Minneapolis climate equity goals. But successful implementation of the code is not just about the standards themselves. We currently do not have all the code enforcement support and technology navigation capacity that we need. This bill and the proposed grants will help close these gaps. Commercial building design and construction projects are increasingly using performance-based compliance paths and energy modeling documentation. Code officials are experts in code, but not necessarily trained in analyzing this type of documentation and need support in reviewing and interpreting project code compliance. When services like this have been available in the past, I have heard from code officials in multiple cities about code enforcement benefits from this support. Some of the services that have been previously available to local code officials were shut down due to loss of federal funds. These large complex projects are particularly common in Minnesota's largest cities. Additionally, architects, developers, building operators and owners, as well as code officials themselves, need more exposure to and guidance on how building technologies, new building technologies, will help meet energy code and provide code compliant buildings. Current new technology examples are electrostatic motors, small footprint geothermal systems, high efficient, ultra efficient heat pumps, and different types of battery storage.
And I will need to have you wrap up. I'm so sorry. Pretty quick here.
I frequently attend events with developers and architects and hear from them about how technologies and navigation and interpretation of these technologies and how they can support code is very vital. The resources of these competitive grants will be essential to build the compliant buildings of tomorrow. And I urge you to consider this bill and this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it looks like you have a second testifier. If you can keep it super duper short, like maybe just 60 seconds, I'm afraid, but identify yourself and proceed.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Nissen. I'm Director of Policy at the Center for Energy and Environment. CEE is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to develop and deploy effective energy solutions that strengthen the economy and improve the environment. And over our decades of experience, we have found that energy codes are a foundational component to ensuring the comfort and affordability of our homes and businesses in the state over the life of the building. And measures that improve comfort and affordability, like those in the energy code, are best implemented at the time of construction. As codes have advanced, so have methods for determining compliance, including performance-based standards. These are intended to give builders flexibility to meet code requirements in different ways, but require additional knowledge and expertise from code officials. So that's why this legislation is so important. It gives municipalities resources to develop, train, and support code officials so they can determine compliance and move projects through the process. And in particular, large cities tend to see larger volumes of large projects. And these tend to take longer times to review, not simply because they're bigger, but because they have more complex systems and are more likely to go through the performance-based compliance pathway. So for these reasons, CEE supports the legislation and appreciates Representative Jones's leadership on this issue.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that. And I failed to ask on the last bill. Anybody in the public who's here and wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing anybody, so we're going to move to member questions or comments. Anybody have questions or comments? I want to clarify something, which is that this makes no change to the code at all. This ensures that that the folks who are enforcing the code have the resources that they need. So, for example, if there's a building, to somebody constructing a building that is in compliance with the code, we want to make sure that everybody's in compliance with the code. So, can you just talk about that? Like, it's not changing any rules. It's just making sure that the rules are actually being enforced in a fair and uniform way. Yes?
That is correct. This is all about supporting compliance implementation.
Okay. Yeah, which seems like we have an interest in that. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I guess I have a question in regard to, in the early 2000s, we had build 'em tight, ventilate 'em right. It included some very advanced technology at the time, as well as products that had never been on the market before. Then came along radon mitigation, which was both passive or mechanical. Things came on the market somewhere in probably the 90s of SIPS homes, which is a whole different building process, but none of this ever required any additional training. I deal with many, many building officials and building inspectors. They all seem to know exactly what they're doing, whether it's an entry-level home or a very, very high technologically advanced energy-efficient home like a SIPS product with geothermal and all that. So why is this needed now? That's my question.
To Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mecklen. That's an excellent question. I'll just say that Energy Code continues to evolve, and especially since the early 2000s, it's been 25 years and probably three or four, or actually even five code cycles have happened since then. And so as our buildings have gotten tighter, we actually, energy modeling becomes even more important so that we're ensuring that that the systems are all working together, because if we don't do that, there can be negative consequences. And so having that greater knowledge of how those systems are then working together is really part of the crux of all of this.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I understand that, and that's why they require us to go to continuing ed every year, which also includes an hour of energy. They also give us tools and resources. We can take our additional classes through, like, Kaplan, if you want to do them online, which I'll be doing this year. But I'm just curious why we have to spend money on this when this is what we've been doing every year from the beginning of my experience in the trade thing. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you so much, Representative Mecklen. How is code enforcement, how does that happen, and pardon my ignorance, in communities under 50,000? I mean, like the statewide co-enforcement, and I'm just looking at the point about this being grants for only populations 50,000 or above. We have members who represent much smaller communities. What's the reason for having larger communities versus any community in the state? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. And I'm totally open as to, like, the how to target this funding. The thinking behind it is that the more, as Will was talking about, the more complex construction and buildings that are being built are typically in bigger cities, and that's where kind of this capacity is really being needed and looked for. And so if there is a need to drop that number, totally open to that.
I could imagine there being a need to drop that number if this were in fact going to advance. We could have some conversations. And I would hope that as training is happening and all, we want to make sure that the code enforcement officials have what they need so that the laws are being enforced in a fair way and those who are doing the right thing are being protected. So we'll see if anybody has anything else. And with that, Representative Jones, I'm going to give you the chance to make a final comment, as I didn't do for Representative Hussein.
I just hope we have excellent news on Friday with the budget forecast, and then you guys get a wonderful target.
Good. We hope that too. With that, thank you to your testifiers. The chair lays over House File 3663. Thank you. And thanks for the good conversation today. Chair Baker, preview?
Just a preview about tomorrow morning, 8:15, we start our meeting. And again, we're going to kind of continue the education conversation about youth and how we're going to be looking at a couple bills. So looking forward to that tomorrow morning. Thank you.
Good. Thank you so much, Chair Baker. Members, thanks for a great conversation today. With that, this meeting is adjourned.